Alright, so moving on to the measurement date of expected credit losses, paper 7, Bernadette.
Okay, so agenda paper 7 addresses two questions raised by one of our submitters regarding whether there is a requirement to measure expected credit losses at dates other than the reporting date, namely the date of derecognition or the date of initial recognition. So firstly, just considering the first question regarding the requirement to measure expected credit losses at the date of derecognition, we would point out that while the impairment requirements of IFRS 9 require entities to measure expected credit losses at the reporting date, where a financial asset has been derecognised between two reporting dates, an entity would also be obliged to consider other more specific requirements of IFRS 9 pertaining to the derecognition of a financial asset. So one of those requirements relates to the calculation of a gain or loss upon derecognition, and that requires a comparison of the carrying value at the date of derecognition and comparing that to the consideration that has been received for that asset. So therefore, when the carrying amount of a financial asset is equal to the amortised cost, an entity would be required to measure that expected credit loss as at that date in order to come up with that amortised cost number. But we would also highlight that in accordance with IS 8, an entity is also obliged to consider the requirements of other standards insofar as the effect is material. So, for example, IS 1 will require that there is a separate line item presented in the statement of profit or loss for derecognition gains or losses and impairment losses and reversals. So then moving on to the second question raised by the submitter regarding whether there is a requirement to measure expected credit losses at the date of initial recognition, we would make a similar observation regarding an entity being obliged to consider the requirements of other standards insofar as the effect is material. So that summarises the issues that are raised in Agenda Paper 7, and so we would just be interested in your views on the two points raised around the date of derecognition and the date of initial recognition.
Okay, good.
Thanks, Sue, and thanks for the summary, Bernadette. When we look into the questions raised, it's about do we have to calculate ECL on the first day when we grant a loan? Respectively, do we have to recalculate the expected losses at the date of derecognition? And I think the standard here is quite clear. In order to determine the P&L impact from granting the loan and basically derecognizing the loan at a certain point in time, we need to have two points in time to compare this to determine what the P&L impact will be. So from that perspective, I think the standard is quite clear. The question now is, how can we do this in practice? I think in order to follow the standard very detailed, you would have to rerun your ECL on a daily basis, which you probably won't do. Let's say when we look into the initial recognition, first of all, I think it's clear that when a loan is put onto the balance sheet, we have no losses, so all the expected losses are factored into the book value, but in the logical minute thereafter, we have expected losses. So this means when I grant a loan, I will have to somehow determine what are my expected losses. Normally, we do not grant always loans at the reporting date, so we need to do it, we usually do it earlier. So there is a time between granting the loan and the reporting date. The question now is, how often do I do my calculation? Some banks maybe do the recalculation only on an annual basis, semi-annual basis. The question is that good enough? Is that materially right? Or is the time between the two dates too long? Too many things can happen in terms of FX, in terms of significant deterioration or other movements which need to be reflected in the provisioning line in FX lines. Most of the more sophisticated banks run the expected loss calculations or plan to run the calculations on a monthly basis. Now the question is that good enough to say, let's say I grant a loan in the mid of the month, is the number I calculate at the end of the month for management reporting purposes or for my report date, is that close enough as a proxy for the expected loss at day one? The same holds true for the derecognition. If I have a usual amortization of a loan, then I think there's a natural end. When all the money is back in the door, the existing expected loss allowance will then be released, so which is left, which might be a tiny amount. If we talk about bullet loans, this might be different. Or if I sell a loan during between two reporting periods. So here I also have to determine the amount of allowance which I show in my P&L as a release, and I want to be as precise as possible and reflecting the most latest information I have in my calculations. So, and in order to determine the drivers of the development. So here again, the question is whether the latest calculation, latest assessment is sufficient, or whether I have to recalculate my ECL at the reporting date. So again, I was very happy that Bernadette also referred to IAS 8 in terms of the materiality. The question is was there a material change between the last reporting or last assessment date and the date when I do recognize? So from my perspective, and this is where at least how we will introduce this, is that we believe that a regular more than annual or quarterly calculation, let's say a monthly calculation, would be a good proxy for the amount of allowances which gets onto the balance sheet via the profit the P&L line, respectively also when we sell or derecognize a loan, that this amount, which is very close to that date, is good enough. There might be certain instances where in that period of time something happens which forces us to maybe in a fire sale exercise, which impacts the assessment or could have could have an impact on the assessment. But this is referring to IAS 8, an event which we should then take into account and recalculate the ECL for that particular item. Okay. So with that, I would like to hand over to George.
No, maybe Graham first.
Okay, Graham.
Thanks, York. First of all, thank you again for the paper. Remarkably well written. We agree with the analysis in it. Of course, you have to consider other accounting standards when considering the implication of this one. I think, and I agree with everything York said, I think just in the discussion of education, it might be helpful to talk about ways in which you might think about materiality in terms of an IFRS 9 estimate. I don't think it would be, I mentioned this particularly in the context of perhaps non-internationally active, perhaps less sophisticated institutions that won't have the bandwidth to do a monthly calculation, which of course we think is a great practice. You need to think about materiality not just in terms of the measure of the expected credit loss. It's also important to think about materiality in terms of income statement presentation. Because largely the impact here is really geography on the income statement. Is the amount hung up in gain or loss on sale, or is it hung up in provision for loan losses, or is it hung up in FX translation, or is it hung up in the provision? So it may be important to consider to what degree are those other line items really important to users. In addition, I think it's important to consider the disclosures, the roll forward of the ECL estimate. Those are really the important things to consider. And there may well be cases where those are just not critical things for a bank's financial statement users. And there may, while we certainly agree with the analysis here that you need to consider it, just back of the napkin thinking, we thought it probably wouldn't be all that common that unless you had a significant change in the composition or nature of the loans, that this would end up being material for most financial institutions. George?
So I think this question arose because people have asked, how often do I have to be prepared to run this calculation? And I think people would like the answer to be, I only have to run it each reporting period, but there are some exceptions. And question one about derecognition, there is a word omitted from paragraph 25, which I think is pretty important out of the standard, that gain or loss must be calculated by comparing the carrying amount measured at the date of derecognition. I don't think that leaves a lot of wiggle room.
Yep.
So in terms, the only issue would be materiality, as Jörg mentioned. And so if you have a large loan book sale, or some other kind of securitization, then you would have to think about that, and hopefully that would only be a rare occurrence. But question two, I actually don't agree with the analysis you folks have prepared, because the inference there is that you need to run this calculation every day you originate a loan just to track the FX. And I think, you know, my view is that if you look in section 5.5, it talks about in paragraphs 5.5.3 or 5.5.5, whether it's 12 months of expected losses or lifetime losses, that measurement is done at each reporting date. At initial recognition, you still recognize financial instruments at fair value, and that's using paragraph 5.1.1. So this reason that's given in question two in the paper, that it's an FX reason that we need to measure it, and again, I also understand that this might cause some grief with the example that's in the standard where we actually show this being done. I don't think that's technically what's required in the standard, and as a result, if you didn't have to run this every day, quite honestly, from an implementation perspective, this is a much more practical outcome. Because running this every day, even for very large institutions, many of whom are in this room, is really not a practical outcome at all. So I think with some references to those two paragraphs that weren't mentioned, and to 5.1.1, that talks still about the same concept we had in IAS 39, that you're going to recognize financial instruments on day one at their fair value, plus or minus transaction costs, I think perhaps relieves us of the responsibility to do it at origination. So comments that are made in paragraph 36 of the paper, that ECL has to be measured at initial recognition, I don't think is technically correct. And I'm hoping that this alternative that I just proposed would relieve us the responsibility to have to do this every day.
I agree with George. And I thought that, you know, there's quite a bit of discussion during the development of the standard around practicality, difficulty of tracking things on a real-time basis, and that influenced some of the disclosures. I agree with George's technical analysis. I think in terms of IAS 21, had a look on some interpretation of IFRIC kind of, and when you get into IAS 21, it's asking you to translate numbers that have arisen under other standards, so it can't independently create a requirement to do a new measurement under IFRS 9. And again, I think on the disclosures under IFRS 7, it's telling you to explain how the numbers you booked have been influenced by various things. And if you have an approach of not calculating ECL initial recognition, but waiting to the reporting date to do that for new loans, then I guess that's what you'll explain you'll do in your IFRS 7 disclosures, and explain how movements on that basis, following that accounting policy, have impacted the numbers. I would say I don't think anybody's precluded from doing things more frequently than each reporting date. That sounds fine, and maybe that some regulators might want them, might require them to do that, but that's going beyond, I think, what IFRS 9 requires.
I think what Jörg described sounded like a fantastic application of IFRS 9. I think a sort of gold standard, which is great if that's happening. On your point on I think what we tried to say in the paper was that there's no sort of explicit requirement in IFRS 9 that thou shalt measure expected credit losses on initial recognition for the sorts of reasons that you two people are mentioning. I think you then need to think about whether there's other requirements and other standards that may cause you to have to think differently, like to properly explain to users of financial statements what's happened in the period, for example. Maybe in extreme cases that might give rise to some requirements. But were you saying, Chris, that if I had a situation where, say I've got an extreme scenario, and I doubt it happens very often, but it could, where I've got a initial recognition and then I have a reporting date that's, sorry, I have a derecognition before I get to the reporting date, yeah? I think that my reading of 3.2.12 would have been that I would need to measure the carrying amount at that date of derecognition. So I think that would be the one case where maybe that would trump the reporting date.
Yeah, I agree. That was part of George's analysis. So on
I just wanted to make sure you weren't saying something
different. Yeah, I think that's fine. But I think it's initial recognition. So in the extreme case, if I originate a massive loan in October and my reporting date is December, I don't think there would be anything wrong in terms of how the standard went. So I initially recognise in October based on the gross carrying amount, and then when it gets to December, I work out what my expected credit losses are. That's how I do the accounting. That's what I disclose under IFRS 7. I don't think I need to do two calculations, one in October and one in December.
Not precluded from having a rush of blood to the head and measuring it every day between October and 31st of December either.
You could do that if you want.
Harvey?
Yes, I also share George's view. I think that it would be a practical issue if we had to recalculate, or let's say calculate, but each origination, the ACL, as expressed in the standards. Otherwise, if we are looking at what are the current practice today, the vast majority of portfolio, people are considering similar profiles of loans or borrowers. And then for each type of profiles, they try to define a proxy of what could be an expected loss. And this proxy is based on aggregates, and it's based on similar profiles of contracts. And that's the way they try to handle that today, because this is not possible to recalculate each time on each loans, these kind of things. So it would not be an appropriate answer to your questions, but
yes,
it could be a proxy.
I know that it wouldn't, but I don't disagree with you, but I'm also trying to read the words in the standard as opposed to whether we like the answers or not. So, George, did you want to come back?
I was going to say that the only other issue about when you may have to recalculate it off a reporting period is also with modification.
Yeah.
So modification, derecognition are both case, where I think you need to remeasure. But the I think the problem is that people look to the illustrative example, 14, and they think that is the answer that has to be done. It has to be done at initial recognition. And so, I understand it is an illustrative example, but frankly, it's probably where more people sort of get it by reading that. And if they're led down the path that I have to do this every time I originate a loan, I think this quickly becomes unworkable.
Okay. So it would be important to emphasize it in the summary of the meeting.
And maybe to add to Chris and George, I think we're talking about newly granted loans. Those are usually granted or put into stage one.
Yeah.
With where we apply the 1 year expected loss. So the question is, how much can really happen between the date when I grant a loan and my first reporting date, other than FX changes? So usually you won't see significant changes in the PDs, you won't see significant changes in the exposure default. You might have some external effects in terms of FX.
Yeah.
That could be. But this is something which needs to be explored, and then I would recommend to really then apply the materiality assumptions.
That's fair. Pablo, sorry, I can't see you when you're done the end there.
I agree with the comments that have been made. I acknowledge the importance of the practical considerations, especially taking on board the many different businesses that banks run, and especially the retail business considerations. However, even if it's not specifically or goes a little bit beyond the remit of this fact pattern, I would echo two things I've heard, one by Georg, on needing to think that right after the loan is granted, there is already an expected credit loss. So however you determine the timing of the measurement of the expected credit losses, that's something that conceptually has to be borne in mind.
Yep.
And that also goes into something Chris said on not precluding banks doing the calculations more frequently than just on the reporting yep. date basis.
And that's fair. Okay, so Bernadette?
Okay. So I think in terms of the question on derecognition, there seems to be a general agreement that the wording in IFRS 9 will, insofar as the item is material, require a recalculation of the expected credit loss as of that date in order to get your line items, etc., in your P&L correctly. However, in respect of the initial recognition date, the additional point raised around the fact that financial instruments on day one should be measured at fair value, and so that would counter any arguments that would require any requirements in IFRS 9 that say that the expected credit loss should be measured at the initial recognition. And I think that in our paper we have tried to indicate that such a requirement could arise due to the requirements of other standards, but like we say, in terms of considering materiality and how often entities want to undertake to redo that calculation. And the other point that was raised was the relevance of such a recalculation upon modification, I think is your point. Other than that, right?
Just to add on to that, that this is one of the things which is there in the standard, is one of the ways of doing it. As George pointed out, people are looking at it to emphasize that's not the only way of doing it.
Right, great. So in terms of where we're at on agenda, you're entitled to a break now, but you're half an hour ahead of schedule, so you've got a choice of whether you want to have a break or whether you want to try and get through paper 5 before we have the break. So. Okay, good. Well, we're on a roll. All right, so agenda paper 5. Back to Hannah.
Yep. Okay, in agenda paper 5, we're looking at the application of the impairment requirements to guaranteed debt instruments, where the financial guarantee contract held is integral to the contractual terms of the financial asset. IFRS 9 requires that cash flows from such integral financial guarantee contracts held should be taken into account when you're measuring expected credit losses, and it's quite clear in that respect. However, the question we've been asked is whether they should also be taken into account when we're assessing whether the credit risk of the guaranteed debt instrument has increased significantly since initial recognition. And to make such an assessment, IFRS 9 tells us to look at the change in the risk of a default occurring. We note that if you exclude recoveries from your financial guarantee contract when you're doing that assessment of significant increase in credit risk on the guaranteed asset, is consistent with the approach in the standard for collateral. The standard points out in several places that collateral and financial guarantee contracts are all part of sort of types of credit enhancements. And as explained in example 3 of IFRS 9, the assessment of a significant increase in credit risk is made irrespective of the value of the collateral, so it doesn't impact your assessment. In addition, excluding recoveries from financial guarantee contracts is also consistent with the guidance in paragraph B5517 of IFRS 9. And this is the guidance which gives some examples that notes that you may look at information about collateral guarantees or other credit enhancements when you are making your assessment, but it emphasises that this is to determine how they influence the borrower's economic incentive to make scheduled contractual payments. That is, how they influence the risk of the borrower defaulting rather than the collateral or a guarantee itself defaulting. So be interested to hear your views on the issue.
Okay, so who's the lucky person?
Me. So I think
in looking at this, you know, the standard is quite clear that you need to look at the risk of default and the increase in that, and that collateral should only be looked at when you're looking at the measurement of your expected losses. An issue that we've been debating a fair bit in the Canadian market is an issue around financial guarantees, and it's particularly over a mortgage product, where we cannot issue certain mortgage products without a financial guarantee from the Government of Canada. So we believe the risk of default on these is extremely low because, you know, ultimately you're looking to the Government of Canada to make whole in the event the mortgage goes bad. The other scenario that we've been looking at is where you have an off-balance sheet or an SPV, and you're granting credit to that SPV, but in underwriting that credit, you're actually looking to a guarantee of a third party. And in that scenario, when you're doing your credit adjudication process, while you're making the loan to the SPV, you're looking at the parent guarantee. And in that scenario, should you be you know, looking at the significant decline or your, you know, the probability of default on the based on the guarantee, not to who you've actually lent the money to. So I think, you know, we appreciate what's in the literature, but we're, you know, trying to separate, to be honest, instruments that are, you know, supported by collateral, because I agree you have to go through the process of realizing your collateral fair value can change, versus you know, a financial guarantee from a third party. So we're looking at that and are sort of wrestling with it within the standard.
Do you think that the words in IFRS 9 make a distinction between those two things?
I don't think so, but we're looking for ways, to be honest.
All right. Wayne.
So
honest response.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We understand the paper. The two elements we're struggling with is exactly what does contractually integrated mean. And a lot of loans are taken out only on condition that there's a guarantee issued with them. And is it just the fact, and we also would have looked at the, I can't read it, B5.5.17K, where a guarantee is given by a parent to a subsidiary. So we looked at a lot of the mortgage guarantee products and the external guarantees, but it equally comes up, even if I look at my own situation, I live in a world of asset protection. I'm an audit partner. I have no assets. So I guarantee I personally guarantee loans, either for my spouse or for various family trusts. The loan was only issued and priced because of my earnings and my guarantee. Now, does it make a difference to it whether I can give the money to my wife in order to service the debt, or I can give the money to a family trust to service the debt, or I'll just pay the debt directly? And I'm struggling to see the principle of where it goes into a 17K as to whether there's been a significant deterioration in that loan. The loan was issued and priced based on me guaranteeing it, or whether external guarantees from a top-up insurer. The banks aren't worried about a significant deterioration, but this standard, as I read the standard, this will now say that it's gone into bucket two. It's going to mean the banks are going to have to now monitor something they don't really have to monitor, and the answer will be zero. You know, the loss provision will be zero. But as a consequence, we're going to have a significant amount of disclosure that very likely will include additional disclosure to say ignore this disclosure. And going on to the disclosure regime, I'm not sure whether this is a useful consequence.
This is going to be one of the circumstances where I'm going to pull us back, I'm afraid, to what the words in the standard say as opposed to what we might want the words in the standard to say. So Helen was very, very well behaved because she was honest in saying that the words in the standard don't distinguish between the two, but you would have liked the answer to be different. So can we focus firstly on whether other people have got different readings of the words and then maybe come back to what we then do? Paul, sorry.
I just thought, I think further wording there to me is quite clear. I think I want to come back to Wayne's example, and I think that's a good example where the actual collateral actually influences the probability of the account going into default. So I think in the example that he put forward, where you know, whatever guarantor ends up ensuring that the payment does happen, then it does change the probability of default. I don't think it actually influences the wording of the standard. I think that is still clear. But I think in that case, there is an influence which needs to be taken.
And I think in that case, and I'm looking, I was trying to pick up Kay to see what it said, given that you were referring to it, and I think that's exactly what Kay was trying to get at from my recollection, that it's trying to get at the fact that would the guarantor actually do something to support the obligor to prevent them going into default in the first place that means you don't actually need to go to the guarantee per se. And I think that the words in 9 would tell you in that case, because it affects the risk of the actual obligor defaulting, that is relevant, but sort of not more generally. So yeah, I'd agree with that observation, but I'm not sure that helps too much in the other examples that are being raised. George?
So we went implemented IFRS in Canada, and we talked about the derecognition standards. They were in IS 39. There was a big argument about, do we have something that's a guaranteed mortgage or a mortgage with a guarantee? You say, are you just splitting words, you're trying to be cute? But I don't think so, because I think there is a difference. If that guarantee is required by law, the mortgage cannot be issued without it. Is it really an attribute of the security? And by law, it has to be done that way. And is that different than someone who goes and issues mortgages and then later, for risk purposes, decides to bulk insure at its own choice something because that's what they want to do from a risk perspective? And so I think there is a difference in this Canadian example with the mortgage insurance that we think we'd like to find a way, and I think they're probably because of that distinction which I just made. And the implication, of course, is for banks who do apply AIRB, who do PD substitutions all over the place, this is going to end up being, again, a very practical problem. All those PD substitutions are going to have to be undone just for the purpose of figuring out between bucket one and bucket two. And we're not, you know, I think the issue there is that really something that people consider to be material disclosure, that distinction between the two buckets when the measurement would be the same? I see the regulators would like to speak, so I hope.
I'm sorry, Karen.
I can go after.
You go, Karen.
First of all, IRB and PD substitution isn't relevant. That's a capital treatment, and it doesn't have anything to do with the accounting. And as you know, Basel is also reviewing all of its IRB, and I believe that PD substitution has been found to be one of those issues that has created divergence from different exposures and is on the list for a consistent application globally. So that, I think, is off the table, and I don't think the regulatory treatment should influence the account. On the accounting side, I think from my understanding of the standard, the words are quite clear, and I thought the objective was to show how credit migrates through, regardless of what the impact to the allowance would be. And I think from a regulatory perspective, we were very clear that we'd like to see that in IFRS 9. Not just what happens to the allowance. And the reason is because the person who gives the guarantee might not be there in the end.
Pablo?
Yes, as Karen just said, we have to focus on the accounting. However, even if we talk about the credit risk management side of it, because we know that this standard is also about or affects credit risk management. And we think about situations, I mean, trying to think about situations where PD substitution or LGD adjustment or even the calculation of double default probabilities might be necessary. I tend to think that it all depends on the business model of each bank, and trying to think of an extreme example where this type of situations might be necessary, or this type of calculations or of alternative calculations might be necessary. I think of central bank refinancing operations. If, for instance, in central bank refinancing operations, when it comes to the management of credit risk stemming from those operations, there is a calculation of the double default probability. But the fact is that that calculation is conducted because if you look at the business of the central bank, it's not about lending, it's not about granting credit, it's about providing liquidity and managing the structure of liquidity shortfall. So extending that or extrapolating that to the banking business, to the private banking business, I would say there could be limited instances in which there might be a case for a double default probability calculation or a PD substitution in terms of credit risk if the business model is not related or is related not only with the granting of credit but with other types of things, also depending on the characteristics of the instrument. But in any case, that would be reflected in the credit risk management of that instrument. So the pricing and the rest of the characteristics of the rest of the terms of that loan would already reflect that double default probability. So turning to the standard itself, I don't think there's any case to replace what's already being said. I mean, as Karen just said, the standard talks about the evolution or is thinking about the evolution in credit risk, whether that's in the credit risk of the debtor or it has to incorporate characteristics of the instrument itself and the business itself, it has to incorporate characteristics of the obligor. Well, that could be the case, but it doesn't affect the requirement to track the evolution of credit risk. So,
Jörg.
Just to add, I think usually when banks grant money, they usually look whether the obligor is in the position to fulfill its obligation and is in the position to repay. And I do not know many cases where credits were granted because we had a very strong collateral situation or very strong guarantor behind. I think in the first place there must be the analysis, is the obligor to whom I grant money in the position to repay the money and not because there's some fallback solution at the end, which in the end reduces my losses to zero. And I think this is well reflected in the concept of the expected loss calculation. I have a PD which reflects the likelihood of default of my obligor. I can take into account collaterals in my LGD, which brings the risk down close to zero. I think this is exactly the case with the Canadian mortgage securities.
Just quickly to add, I agree with what Georg is saying, and I also agree that primarily it could result in disclosure because the provision will be zero. But there are instances where your LGD will not turn to zero because of the collateral, and then the shift from stage one to stage two will create an impact on the amount of the provision that's being carried. So we need to be cognizant about that, and that's why I think the flow issue and what the standard requires also comes in. So it's not just a disclosure issue, it can turn into an actual number having an impact in the P&L.
John.
Thanks. So I generally agree. I agree with where the paper has landed, where the staff have landed. I agree with what York said, that you would generally look at the obligor's ability to repay, not in all circumstances. There are certain circumstances where you may not be particularly interested in the obligor, and I can think of parent company guarantees to subsidiaries borrowing off banks, where the banks would not necessarily lend to the subsidiary without the parent guarantee, and they are looking to the parent guarantee. and also situations where banks may have sold loans to bad banks where they would not have done it if they didn't have the state guarantee, and the only reason they did it was it was maybe a state requirement, but secondly they did it because they needed to repo the paper, and to repo the paper they needed the state guarantee. So I think the paper lands in the right place. I just wonder for certain circumstances whether there's a unit of account issue we could look at. And certainly paragraph 98 of IFRS 13, looking at the fair value of liabilities, does talk about fair value and liability with a credit enhancement as one and being allowed. So I just wondered, is there something there? But just to maybe to go back to your point, Sue, you're talking about Helen, I think the standard is quite clear, but the way the paper lays it out is, I think, where the standard directs you. I just wonder, is that right for all circumstances, particularly the parent subsidiary position?
All right. Graham.
Thanks, Sue. I kind of echo John's thought there. I think it's probably, just to come up with a couple examples off the top of my head, I think it's important not to talk about this in a way that would encourage people to ignore collateral. You think about a mortgage borrower, the value of their home significantly influences their willingness to repay that loan, right? If you've got equity in your home, you're much more likely to keep paying. If you don't, you're much more likely to walk away. I think another thing, particularly to John's point, is you might think about a business owner who takes out a loan under his own name, but his sole source of repayment is, and the collateral on the loan is, cash flows from the underlying business. And so there may not be a real distinction in that case between borrower and cash flows on collateral. So I know a common concept in the United States is primary source of repayment versus secondary source of repayment. I think to John's point, that may be a meaningful concept when thinking about this is, are we sort of getting substance over form here and saying, well, that's really collateral? Well, if the collateral is the primary source of repayment and the legal structure of the credit is such that it's, you have sort of a non-substantive borrower, does that really make sense that you would, because you'd almost initially put, it would almost be a credit impaired origination at that point if you thought about it like that. So I think that idea of primary source repayment, secondary source repayment may be an important concept for this.
Okay.
I just wanted to come back to John and Graham in terms of collateral and parent guarantees. And I think from a regulatory perspective, when we looked at the work to create the expected credit loss model, we were very concerned about considering collateral in determining credit risk. And I think from a regulatory credit risk management perspective, we didn't think that should be considered, because really we wanted to see that the credit risk is happening regardless, because things can happen with collateral and guarantees. And if you grant the loan based on what you think will be there and it's not there, then it's a surprise. And what we didn't want in this standard was surprises. We wanted this standard to be forward-looking. So from our perspective, we don't think that there is exclusions of collateral or guarantees that should be considered in terms of the determination of the credit risk.
Chris?
I agree with many of the comments made. I think that when you read the standard, it's reasonably clear that to exclude the guarantee protection in determining whether there is credit risk. And just in some of these situations, we talk about parent subsidiary structures, etc. I mean, you can get a slightly different fact pattern where you have some co-borrowers with joint several liabilities. But I think if you had that situation, you get a different answer, because then you're saying, well, I've got two primary obligors. And I consider that the credit risk of both of them jointly in terms of making the assessment. In terms of interpreting 5517, I mean, the only way that I could see that you could consider getting some separate answer is if you wanted to try and be very creative with the definition of default, because it talks about whether the guarantee would reduce the probability of default occurring. the standard doesn't define default. So, you know, if you said something like, okay, well, I've made a loan to somebody for this type of loan, in terms of what my definition of default is, I'm going to consider, firstly, whether the person who makes the loan doesn't pay and their capacity to pay, but also whether I might recover fully under the guarantee within a certain period. And then you sort of you could get an argument that, yep, in terms of its form, satisfies 5517, but I don't think that was
hopefully
really
we'd
the
all agree that was a disingenuous application of IFRS 9. Yes. Kumar?
Just quickly coming back to the point Graham was making, I think you were talking about the phenomenon of keys in the post in the US when the equity value comes down. Absolutely agree, that does affect. And I think the standard does cover that. That's when we say that the collateral value and the PD can be.
I was just going to refer to a side issue that's also referred to in the staff paper, and Graham referred to it. I think it's important to consider, although it's not the bulk of the fact pattern that's being questioned. It's the issue on the repayment incentive. I think it's example number 5, where it clearly states, and I think it's really important to consider this, that those incentives are affected basically where the terms of the loan favor that kind of situation. What I mean is, if the loan is granted on very high loan to values at origination, that loan is, or the incentives by borrowers, that loan is going to be more sensitive to declines in house prices than other. Except in those cases, or in extreme shocks in the price of the collateral, I don't think the equity of the borrower into the mortgage, for instance, really has a bearing on the incentive. What I mean is that, again, this is a relative model. You have to consider what happens at origination. So if the loan is granted on very aggressive terms, that's more likely to be affected, or the incentives of the borrower are more likely to be affected by what happens on the price of collateral.
Okay, I'm going to try and wrap up. So I think that most agreed, whether or not they liked the implications of it, that IFRS 9 is clear that it makes a distinction between the default on the instrument and the effect of collateral or financial guarantee contracts. So the focus is on the risk of the default, so that collateral is only really relevant to the assessment of the significant increase in credit risk, as opposed to the measurement of expected credit losses, if it were, for example, to have an effect on the likelihood of the default occurring, which is what's reflected in 5517. And I know that some of you don't like that, but I think that was the design of IFRS 9, and for the reasons that I think Pablo and Karen in particular focused on, and also Jurg, which is, we thought that there was information value, which people may disagree with, but we felt there was information value in knowing to which extent you were really relying on the support as opposed to the obligor by moving between stage 1 and stage 2, and so that's what IFRS 9 is capturing. I think the only thing that I sort of will leave open, don't want us really to discuss this, but just as a thought, a closing thought, is that when we use terms like integrated guarantee, I've got no idea really what that means, and I suspect it could mean different things to all of us in the room if I was to give you an exam question and you had to write an answer, so I'm always nervous what that means. And also I can't pretend to understand exactly how all these guarantee structures work. I think the design of IFRS 9 is really focusing on this concept that you would have a sort of technical default, if you like, by the borrower, and then as a consequence the guarantee kicks in and support is provided. So you sort of have a default, and in an instant you might get support. If the structure was such that in effect that guarantee kicked in before there was even a technical default, then I think maybe there could be something to look at there. But I think that would be the only thing I would add, and I don't want to really go into it further than that. That's a risky comment, but just a thought. Because I think it's all about sort of default followed by collateral recovery is the design concept that we've got there. Now I think we have earned our break, so let's have a 15-minute break until 11:30. Thank you.